Yeah, I'm really big buddy. Walked away from two of them like that. It was a whole car full of people just.
Well, I'll tell you, I got when I was in high school, I had two friends and they got drunk, and one of the guys killed another guy in a car wreck. That motherfucker is still crazy. I mean, 20 years later, you know. Not 20 years, but, you know, 10 years later, the guy I saw, last time I saw him was in Salt Lake City, and the kid was from, like, a real respectable family and everything, and he's been in prison twice now. And I saw him in Salt Lake City. His fucking pants were ripped up to here, you know, and they had no shoes on. It was cold out, and I'm in my hotel room, and he says, and I'm getting out of the shower, getting ready to show him. This was last year, and I hear this voice that goes, "Hey, man." I go, "Who's this?" "Hey, this is Dave Silk," and I'm like, "Dave Silky," you know, it's like, he's the type of guy that if you ain't nice to him, he'll kill you, he'll beat your ass now, but it all stemmed from when he killed that kid when he was 16 years old. He's amazing. He came to my hotel room, he had no shoes on, and had a fucking dog with him, the ugliest girl in the world, you know, and it took him backstage, and he fucking, you know, he was like, he'd never seen food for so long. He's like same age as me, you know. It's amazing. I guess it would fuck with it, you know.
Anything really powerful like that ever happened in your background that you figure has some effect on you now?
No, not really to me. The only thing, it's stupid. I had a neural surgery when I was born, and I always figured nothing can happen to me because I already had it, you know, when I was born. I feel like sometimes sometimes I have this false security that I can't be touched because, look, if I was going to bite it, I would have bit it then, you know. Because, you know, neurosurgery in 1951 was, you know, not happening, you know. So, then after the operation, I told my parents, they said, you might as well just put him in a home because he's going to be a waterhead. They thought the surgery was a failure. Might as well put him in a home because he'll die by the time he's 7. My parents kept me, and fuck, I'm 28 now, and I ain't dead yet. So, I guess, and another girl in my hometown had the same operation. She's paralyzed from her down. She move her neck, can't move her hands, can't move her legs. And they told her parents that the operation was a success. You know, it was the same fucking deal. I had a great big growth on the back of my head, like as big as an adult fist on the back of a baby's head right here. I got a scar that goes from here to here, something like 37 stitches. And I didn't even know I had it till, I didn't even know I had that operation until I was 10, 11 years old. Hell,
when
I thought.
When did you have it?
I think I was 3 weeks old, 3 or 4 weeks old. And my mom and dad tell me now that this guy from Germany came in, my old man was in the service, and they filmed it and all that kind of shit because it was like, you know, it was like they showed the film in colleges, and it was like one of the first surgeries of its kind. So, you know, I feel like, you know, hey, man, you know, if I was going to eat the shit, I'd been eating it by now, you know.
I guess when you know you've been through something like that, then maybe some of the pain and heartache of trying to break into a business like this isn't so tough, or was it? I don't know.
Well, see, like, it really, I was unaware of it till I was older, you know. So I really didn't need that effect of me. But now that I'm older, I realized the ramifications of the whole thing, and it was like, wow, it was on the line, you know.
How was breaking into the business for you?
Slow. You know, real slow. I don't know. I've made 5 albums, and I've managed to stay pretty anonymous over the last 5 years, which is cool with me, you know. I mean,
how long do you actually spend in the studio? I
spent 2 months on that record.
Steve Crowder.
Yeah, you know, and it.
I'm going to be doing a special on producers around February or so. Actually, what it is undated material I can cut in advance so I can go on vacation. But I'm going to do a thing on putting together a record. That 2 weeks in the studio, what specific part did Cropper play in? I mean, I know what a producer is, but
right.
For the audience. Well, great. He's I met him up in Boston after the Blues Brothers movie when it first came out.
Right.
Well, we met the whole band. What an afternoon that was.
Steve is a real down to earth Southern boy, you know. And yeah, really. And him and Duck, he told me that him and Duck have been together. The first band Cropper was ever in, him and Duck were in the band together. I mean, that goes back, doesn't it?
Where do you come from?
I come from Seymour, Indiana. 14,000 people. Not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. You know, it's not much. I'll tell you.
How do you figure that's figured into your life?
Well,
your music.
I think that growing up in small towns, you know, and you get in this place like New York, Los Angeles, Paris, You know, you grow up, and you know, cities like that represent success to a lot of people. That's why people go to cities, because they see all these big buildings, everything that man has done. And it's, I think for people who grew up there, a lot of them, and I'm generalizing, they think the moon is theirs and they can get it, and they grow up believing that. Whereas when you grow up in Indiana, you know, you're lucky if you can get a hamburger and a French fries and a girl that night. I mean, that your limitation, your scope of life is so small. You know, maybe I'm misreading the whole city life, I don't know. But your whole life is, you know, when you're dealing with your, you know, my graduating class had 200 people in it, high school class. You know, and it's like, nobody makes records from Seymour, Indiana. As far as I know, I'm the only guy that ever has, you know. And that's cool now, but when you're 21 years old, you say, I'm going to go to New York, make records, people are saying, no, you ain't. You just think you are. You can go if you want to, but you'll be back in 2 weeks. You know, it's kind of like that song, that country song, people think I'm a big deal here in Detroit City, you know. People like to try to keep you down, you know what I mean? Like my father, he says, you know, well, look, you know, you can go there if you want to, but it ain't going to happen. And I think the reason they do that is because they all had dreams and really didn't reach out for them the way they should have. So they want you to reach out for your dreams, but they want to warn you in advance that it probably won't happen.
Low ceiling.
Right, yeah. And I think they think they're doing it for your better, for, you know, doing it for you. But with me, I was lucky. I mean, you know, I had written 3 songs, went to New York and had a record deal within a month. You know, it was like...
I don't think I ever really realized what a small town was about until I took this cross-country trip a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this place in Idaho, where I stayed along the Columbia River, I went into the restaurant, you know, near the campground, and I said, let me have 2 large coffees to go. And the woman says, well, we ain't got but one size. I tried to get those big cups, but they just won't send them out here.
That's it. That's what it's about, you know. I mean, that, you know, and as stupid as it may sound, that was something that woman was interested in, getting the big cups in the thing. But the boss, he wasn't interested, you know. And that's what people do there, you know.
You talked about 5 albums in anonymity. You had a pretty big hit on the last one. What kind of a difference do you think that's made in coming into the studio to do Nothing Matters, and if it did?
Really none, except that I think that... you know, I'm just learning, just now, after 5 albums, after, what is that, 10 albums, after 50 songs on records, I'm just now learning how to write songs. I mean, I feel like I Need a Lover was something I needed to say, hey, look, you can write a song that people do want to hear. You know, so it kind of gave me the strength to further go. You know, if the last record would have been a flop, I would have might have thought, I don't know why I keep making these records, because nobody wants to hear them. And another thing about it is I never, ever thought I'd be writing songs to be on the radio, because when I was growing up, the artists I liked weren't on the radio. You know, you never heard Lou Reed on the radio, you know. But that was when I was like 18, 19, you know. That's when there was a progressive music, which I don't feel there is anymore, progressive music. But to take it back even further, the reason I think I can write these songs is because when I did grow up in Seymour, Indiana, there wasn't any FM in the early 60s. There was an AM station called WAKY from Louisville, Kentucky, and they were playing Eric Burdon, and they were playing Otis Redding, and they were playing Sam and Dave. And so those songs were credible songs that had nice melodies that people wanted to hear. I guess just good pop songs. Now, I don't want pop to be confused with new wave pop, which is not the same thing at all. But I mean good pop songs that you can sing along with, and I think take on some kind of meaning in people's lives. You know, when I hear Sitting on Dock the Bay, it means something to me. You know, when I hear We Gotta Get This Place, it means something to me. When I hear Pretty Vacant, it don't mean nothing to me. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's you know, trends and stuff like that, you know, I'm not into them. But the for real thing, like Dock of the Bay or something like that, you know, those are for real songs, you know, that mean something, and they... And Otis and Steve put their soul into that song. Pretty Vacant, somebody put An Hour's With a Clever Thought into, or a lot of the songs like that.
Nothing Matters and What If It Did sounds like something you'd read in a Kurt Vonnegut novel. Do you read Vonnegut?
I read a lot. I don't read a lot, but I you know, that's my other, you know, it's like my, what I want to do someday is write short stories. I like Trout Fishing in America. You ever read that? Oh, it's great. Willard and the Bowling Trophies. And I don't know, I like satire, satirical things on American way of life. Trout fishing in America, you know, everybody thought it was about fishing, but it's like a put down on the American way of life, which, you know, is really funny. You know, the competition and, you know, everybody, you know, to coin something I just heard this morning on television, nobody ever sits back in a big luxury armchair and a cigar and go in a, you know, on Central Park South and, you know, 20,000 good looking secretaries. He never sits back and go, well, I finally made it, you know.
I think I got enough.
That never happens, you know. And I don't know, it just seems ironic that the things that we want are the things that kill us early, you know.
When you heard I Need a Lover on the radio, all over the place,
mm-hmm.
did you feel like at some point that I made it, or at least I made some plateau?
Well, to be real honest with you, I don't think I Need a Lover is that great a song. To be real honest, I think it's an okay song. When I hear I Need a Lover on the radio, well, matter of fact, when I hear any of my songs on the radio, I feel like the guy at the record company has done his job. That's what I feel like. Because I know that I Need a Lover was a big hit record, but there were 40,000 other records that were just as good as I Need a Lover that the record company put out, didn't get immediate response on, and they said, forget it. There's so many records that I hear that are so good, you know, that as far as radio songs should be on the radio, but because the guy in here pushing it at somebody, or there isn't something illegal going on, you know.
There was somebody pushing it for sure, but I mean, there was something about that song too that people could just, yeah.
Well, see, I attribute that all to luck. I get my old man always told me, you make your own luck, you know. But I mean, you know what I'm talking about. Take some of the records home that never get on the radio. And listen, there was a band I can't remember. I think the name of the band is Prism, and they had a record out called Young and Restless. Band was pretty not cool, but man, they had some hit records on that album. There were two songs, American Music and Young and Restless, I think that's what it's called, yeah, that were like amazing. And I can name hundreds. There's a guy named Tommy Two Tone now that should have had some hit records, and he had kind of okay records. You know, these aren't my favorite acts or anything like that, but I mean, I hear these records as being hit records, and I just feel like somebody didn't do their job for these records. And there's millions of more. And there's songs a lot better than I Need a Lover that never happened. But I guess, you know, I Need a Lover in itself, I mean, that's a phrase that, like, nothing matters, and what if it did, you know? It's something that people can take seriously or not take seriously. It's across the board, you know, slogan.
What about the writing that went into this? Any particular tales that, on any particular tunes that might be of interest?
Well, I, you know, rock and roll songs are not to be taken too seriously, I don't think. I think, you know, the 60s was the 60s, and what made Dylan prolific in the 60s does not make Dylan a good writer now. I mean, all those things are over. I think people who try to cling to making rock and roll something that is not, you know, trying to get too involved in the lyrics, it's nice fantasy, but doesn't really exist. Because I know too many people that write, and I know how they write. And, you know, I'd like to say, hey, I'm the only breed that still writes from the heart and still tries to get a little life on plastic. But that ain't true. I got to be honest, you know. And I go into studios and watch people make records, people you wouldn't even believe. And they're taking stuff from here, and they're stealing this from that. And I mean, tell you, it's almost the art form. And I think there's a few artists that are real good at it. The art form almost is steal from the best and forget the rest, you know. And I've seen that done, and I know it's done, you know, by everyone. I mean, I've worked with the best producers in the world, you know.
Did you do any stealing here?
Oh, yeah, sure. There's things on here that, you know, I don't think they were, to be honest, they're not blatant. Let's steal this. But when you play something and you hear something, you say, oh, I know where that came from. That's from this, you know. That idea was spawned. But I guess that in itself is creativity. You know, you're inspired for what you hear and see and think, you know. So there's, you know, like there's a song on the album called Cheap Shot that initially I had no idea where it came from, but after we wrote it and the band arranged it, hey, it's an Eddie Cochran song, you know. Eddie Cochran be proud, you know. So I mean, you know, I got to, and that's where it's at, you know, because, you know, there's seven notes, and, you know, there's nothing new anymore to it.
Do you have any kind of a formula for, not necessarily a formula, but do you have a setting when you want to write, or is it just, you know, something goes into your head and you're Jonathan?
Yeah, that's what I do. I'm not, songs have formulas. I mean, and they don't always work, but there's a certain format to write a song. You got to have a verse, chorus, and the thing that always screws me up is the bridge. Because you got the verse and chorus and to go along real good, and I got to write this bridge, you know, and it's like, where's this? It's almost like another song comes into the song, but you have to break it up, you know. And supposedly that's the way you write songs.
You have to break it up. Be a little bit more specific for the audience and what the age is.
Well, you have like a melody, which is like the melody, I've been walking the streets in the evening, racing through the human jungles at night. That's the melody of I Need a Lover. And then the chorus is I need a lover that won't drop. That's so you've got two distinct melodies there. And then a bridge is like almost a counter melody, which is in a different key or in a minor key, which makes, because if I just did those two melodies for 3 minutes, people would go, you know, see ya. So you've got to add this guitar bridge or another verse that's a different melody. So that's, you know, what a bridge is. Yeah, oh yeah, it's hard because, you know, you get this nice flow going with the verse chorus. All of a sudden you think, oh my God, I got to break this up because... you know, it's just not enough. You got to have three melodies in a song, and a lot of times more than that. I mean, for an example, I Need a Lover, I bet it's got 5 and 6 melodies happening in that song all the time, because you got guitar melodies, you've got bass lines that create melodies. It's a real interesting thing to write songs, but I haven't written a song now for 3 months. Ever since I got off the record, I haven't written a song. I haven't even tried to write a song.
When do you think you'll start on the next one?
Well, see, I don't know. When I'm not a guy like, you know, I hear guys like Neil Sedaka talking about writing songs, how they go in the room and lock themselves in the room for 8 hours a day. And I think, wow, I bet that's inspiring, you know. And listen to his records. They sound so uninspired, it's ridiculous, you know. And that's why when people come down on people like Springsteen or Jackson Brown for taking so long in between records, well, you get your choice. You either get a lot of records that ain't no good, or you get one or two that are good, you know. And putting a little bit of emotion on plastic and trying to get rid of the pretentiousness of rock and roll and putting on record is real hard to do. Now, if that's what you want a record every 6 months, Neil Sedaka is making records, you know, for you. So, you know, I can't really come down. I mean, I think with Springsteen, 3-4 years is a little long, but I know for a fact that on Brown's new record, like it or not, he'd only written 8 songs for that record, and there's only 8 songs since On the Road, whatever his last record was. 8 songs. He'd only written 8 songs in a period of 3 years. 8 songs is hardly an album, you know? So whether you like it or not, I mean, that's all the more inspired he became.
Because Bruce is going to give us a 2-record set now.
A lot of short songs. Yeah, a lot of short songs, I understand. I was fortunate enough, the guy who designed this album cover, the new album cover, was doing Jackson Browns and Springsteen's at the same time. So it was like he was talking to them, and I was, you know, I'm a fan of both of them. So I was saying, well, you know, what's going on with Springsteen's record? You know, Springsteen recorded 40 songs for this album. That's it.
You're concentrating on the tour now.
Well, we were out a month with the Kinks before the album even came out. You know, that's a pretty silly thing to do, to go out on tour with no product out. But we needed it to get back in shape after playing out on the road. And I like the playing of it. I like to get on stage and play when things are happening. I don't like checking into hotels and your room's not ready yet, you know. I mean, it's the petty things that get on top of you on the road. You know, the real little minute things that most people in day-to-day life would ignore, you know. But when you're on the road, those are the things that get on top of you. Your room's not ready. Restaurant's taking 87 years to cook you a hamburger when, you know, you got to be someplace. People in the field for the record company not doing their jobs, going to radio stations and the guy not being there that's supposed to be there. Those are the things that make me mad. Doing interviews with people. The worst thing that I hate is doing interviews with people who have got a preconceived attitude of what you're going to be because of your record. And they approach you with this attitude. You know what I mean? It's like, I did an interview with a magazine in New York not too long ago. And this guy, you know, he was telling me what I was doing. You know, why did you write this song? And I said, well, you know, it's just a song. And then he proceeded to tell me why I wrote it, you know, and was very dictatorial to me about this. And when I disagreed, you know, it was like, you're wrong. And I thought, oh, well, I thought I wrote the song, but I guess you did, you know.
Well, he had his article written, you know. Before you know,
yeah, I shouldn't even showed up, you know. Hell, he didn't need me. Oh, another thing that really makes me mad. Well, that doesn't make me any mad anymore. It's funny now. Everywhere I go, I have guys come up to me and they go, man, how'd you get into business, you know? And I used to always give them a little short synopsis, about 3 or 4 minutes. Say, this is what you got to do, yada, yada, yada. And I got this is funny, I got from so many people, no, you don't. That's not how you do it. I thought, well, excuse me, you know, I thought that's the way you did it, you know. But then I said, well, then what the hell did you ask me for, you know? If you know, go ahead and do it.
A couple of questions for future use. One for our year-end special. What do you see for John Cougar in 81, and where do you expect to be by, say, 85?
Well, in 81, John Cougar will be on the road, most definitely. And for 85, if I manage to maintain the same up thrush that I'm doing now, I'll be doing another album in 5 years, and you'll be going, hey, you had a hit record last year, but, you know, you're pretty invisible still. But, I don't know, I kind of like it, you know. I make enough money that, you know, I got a little house in Bloomington, and, you know, the work is not in Bloomington. I go home, and it's like I go there to write. The work is here, you know, the work is out in the field. So, I don't know, I don't, my goal is not to be Elton John. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be. I hate rock stars. Is what I'm trying to say. Rock stars are people who pull their pants up real tight so you can see their luggage between their legs and shag haircuts and the scarves on their neck and a lot of gold and a lot of rings. So I'm not into any of that. You know, rock and roll is not a glamorous business. The entertainment business is the glamorous business. I'm just a kid from Indiana trying to write songs and make a living. And I don't want no limousine waiting for me. I have no use for them. Never was impressed with people who rode in them. Won't be impressed with myself if I get in them, you know. And
of course, it wouldn't hurt to have somebody take care of that hotel room for you.
Well, it'd be nice to be able to walk into a Holiday Inn and have some towels in there when you want to take a shower. But you know, that's where I'm at. You know, I mean, I like walking in on people and meeting them on a one-on-one level, and being friends with people. And I see so many people that think they're successful in the business, and they get this attitude about them, and that they're too good to do this, and they're above all that now. Well, I'm through with that portion of my life. Hey, you ain't never through with being nice to people. Even though I'm an asshole a lot of the times to people I'm around, I think it's important that just in me being happy with myself, you know, to come in here and, you know, try to have some sort of rapport with you, and try to have some sort of rapport with anybody else. Because who needs some guy coming in and going, yeah, well, you know, I'm pretty fucking groovy. You know, I make records. Yeah, well, yeah, maybe I can get you backstage. You know, yeah, you know. Yeah, I mean, who needs that?
Other question for future use: what is the date of your birth?
October
7th,
1951.
Oh, coming up.
Yeah, I'm gonna be an old man for a long.
What kind of things do you appreciate in the gifts, or what was a gift once that really knocked you?
Oh, I don't know. I think the best gift I ever got was my first motorcycle when I was 14 years old. I turned 14, and my old man bought me a motorcycle, and it was like I've been on them ever since. I just like it, you know. I like motorcycles, I like motocross, I like the woods, the ride in the woods. There's something very intense about going 50 miles an hour through a wood on a little path, you know. It's like total concentration on what you're doing. Because if you don't, adios, you know, you're gonna get burnt. And I like that. It sounds cliche and corny, everything I know, but I like the idea of riding it right at the edge like that. It's something thrilling to me, you know, to be able to do that. More thrilling than laying around watching television, you know. Read. I'm trying to read the news. And all these Vietnam names are coming on. And nobody told me that's not the shit you read. You read the stuff you can read. And I'm going, and last night in Saigon, it was like, oh God. And everybody called up and said, great newscast. It was like, screw the show. You know, rock and roll's rock and roll. I was on the radio in Vincennes, Indiana, on a little steamy station that you had to be on the air to get your college credits, right? And I was on from 9 till midnight every night. Everybody hated my show because I was playing all this esoteric music, but they loved the news, you know. It was like the news, the kids all over the campus would call up and go, man, this word was wrong, that word was wrong, this was right. It was like, oh, God.